40 years ago, if you were asked to define the American family, you could probably sum it up in a statistic. The one I remember most is a father, a mother, and 2.24 children. In 1992, if you were asked to define the family, you really couldn't quantify, I think. If you summoned the calculator, you really would be begging the question. I'm Susan McInnes, this is Conversations, and our guest for this program is Dr. Thelma Harms, who's been working with children and studying kids for about the past 40 years. Pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
I want to check that against you. My assumption is that the American family is now a large, complex, and whirling universe, and no simple statistic will do. Is that
absolutely
accurate?
Sure. We've got a lot of teen parents, single parents. We have blended families where it's not only his, hers, and theirs, but it can be his from several marriages, hers from other relationships, and perhaps theirs. So we have extended families where we might have two or more different families sharing a residence together. I think the American family has become not only complex, but we define it through relationship rather than the people, the individuals in the relationship.
Yeah. Has the American family kind of gotten away from us? It seems to me in some ways there's a nostalgia for father, mother, and 2.24 kids that would actually, I don't know whether it's a matter of wanting to bring it back so much as maybe it interrupts our recognition of what the family is today. Do you think that's true? Has it passed us by?
It may actually come back a little bit. I've been delighted to see a number of people in my own acquaintance that are getting married and are wanting to have children. Women who just a few years ago were absolutely devoted to a career are saying, I think I'm going to stay home with my children at least for the first year. Mm-hmm. So we may be seeing some return of a more traditional family in some segments. But I think that our inner cities have gone to such a dreadful state as far as single parents and unwed mothers. We're not going to be able to turn that all around rapidly. I think I was very interested. I was in Sweden a couple of years ago, and I was so interested to see three-generation families out on Sunday in the park. Nice. It was fascinating. You'd see mother and daddy with their children and grandma and grandpa. And it was not an unusual thing. You had the feeling that there was more cohesion in the family. And, you know, it was Margaret Mead who talked about the need for a three-generation family. We see that so rarely here, mm-hmm. I think.
Is there a healthiest state for the family as defined by its members or defined by its experience?
I think certainly it's a good thing to have two parents to raise a family. It's a very difficult job, even if you have a sufficient amount of money and somebody that is spending time earning the living primarily, and somebody else that is, as my mother used to say, spending time making the living worthwhile. I think it's easier to do that if you have a stable relationship with a mother and a father who really want to raise children. I think anyone would agree mm-hmm. to that. I think there are lots of alternatives. If you just look at what's needed, if you could get an arrangement, and sometimes that has been necessary, where two single parents get a household together and share the babysitting and back one another up, share the work. That works too. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if there's an optimum way of raising children. I just know that you do need enough time to do it, and you have to have a parent who is primarily there for the children during the time that the children are home. And you have to have somebody backing you up as well. You can't be with children 24 hours a day, as many single parents are, and still enjoy it. It's very tough.
And in today's economy, where things are tighter and tighter, even in the 90s than they were in the 80s, it's very difficult to have that. We think of it now as a luxury, what
it
used to be
a
given.
It is a luxury. But again, if I could talk a little bit about Sweden.
Sure.
And this is something that's always puzzled me about the United States. I've seen other countries do so much a better job of supporting young families. Well, when I was in Sweden, I was absolutely astonished to see how many mothers there were and fathers out on the street with their children during the day. You can go into any American city and you won't see that. You simply will not see parents outside with their little children. Where are those kids? They're in daycare. Where are the parents? They're working. In our country, we have about 52% of all women with babies under 1 year of age in the workforce. Now, in Sweden, they have 85% of their women working, and yet you saw women out on the street, men out on the street with their tiny babies. Why? Because in Sweden, any person who has a baby, any woman who has a baby, is entitled to 18 months of paid maternity leave, paid parenting leave is what it is, at 90% of her salary. If her husband wants to take the parenting leave instead of her, or they want to share it, he can get parenting leave, or she can get it, for 90% of their salary for 18 months.
And this is paid for by whom?
It's
by what?
It's paid for by the employers and by the government. And their theory is this: if you have a good worker who has her job guaranteed and you give this person parenting leave, you take care of two problems at once. The first problem that you take care of is you don't have to retrain people. You bring them back into the workforce and they're going to work for you, mm-hmm, because they have gotten something that they want very much. So their job is a valuable thing to them. The second thing you take care of is that those little babies are not put into daycare where they might not get as good personal care as they would at home. So the Swedes believe that you give family support at the front end so that you get a healthier workforce, both as far as the parents are concerned, they're a happier workforce, and you give the child a good start so that by the time the child is a year and a half old, the kid can be put into a good daycare center, also supported by the municipalities, mm-hmm, by the government. They get practically free daycare. It's very inexpensive. And you have a healthier, happier child who then becomes a better worker and a better citizen. We don't do that. Our philosophy is, let them take care of their kids themselves. We make it very, very hard on young families. They're financially strapped. You must have two parents working in most families. There are a lot of single-parent families. They have to go to work. They have to put their children into daycare. The daycare teachers are not paid enough. Daycare centers are not supported enough. And we find ourselves picking up the pieces when the kids are in school or when they're teenagers. We seem in this culture to prefer to work with the problems that we don't try to prevent. I've never understood that.
This is Dr. Thelma Harms. She is with us from North Carolina, where she is the Director of Curriculum Development at the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Center at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She is also the Director of the Daycare Technical Assistance Training System, also there at the University of North Carolina. Dr. Thelma Harms with us today on Conversations. We're talking about kids and parenting. Why do the Swedes know something that we don't know? Or what is it that we believe that the Swedes don't?
Well, you know, it's not only the Swedes, it is most of the industrialized countries in the world seem to know that it's better to prevent problems than it is to deal with them later on. For example, you can even roll it back. The Swedes and the Germans and the British and the Canadians, we don't even have to go abroad, the Canadians, give prenatal care to everyone. You have the right to prenatal care. We don't do that. We're very selective. You have to have the money, or you have to be so poor that you can get Medicare. We don't give expectant mothers the prenatal care as a basic right, as a prevention measure, so that we have babies born who are healthy. It seems very short-sighted to me. I think the difference is that in the United States, we have the feeling that we don't want to socialize. We don't want to take social responsibility for a lot of issues that we have always considered personal issues.
Man's home is his castle. You ought to pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
That's it.
See.
Yeah. I can remember not so very long ago when people were terribly upset when we started to talk about health insurance. They'd immediately bring along out socialized medicine. Do you want socialized medicine? It has these problems and those problems. Well, now suddenly everyone is talking about the need for health insurance. And it's absolutely true. We all need health insurance. And I prepared a few statistics here about health insurance. I thought this was very, very interesting as far as families were concerned. And what I found out was that 30% of married couples whose families fall below the U.S. poverty level are not covered by any health insurance.
They don't fall far enough down? Is that
well,
the problem?
Well, they are below the poverty level, but for some reason they do not qualify, because they are married couples perhaps. They don't qualify for health insurance, including Medicaid. They don't qualify for it. Now, on the other hand, only 13% of female-headed households below the poverty level don't get health insurance. So, in other words, if you're a member of a married couple, of a family with a mother and a father, and you're poor, in some ways you're being penalized. Now, you asked me the question, what do people in countries that provide prenatal care, that provide good parenting leave, that try to give support to families, what do they know that we don't know? And I think what they know is that children are the workers of tomorrow, that children make up our labor force, and that really they are a social responsibility. We know that as far as public education is concerned. We wouldn't think of not having a public school system because we want an educated workforce. Now, it seems to me that daycare is an extension, a downward extension of that public responsibility for education.
Isn't this a case of daycare in particular, a case of the institution preceding any sort of policy?
That's
grew up
right.
out of need before we realized it was there?
Right, absolutely. It just grew up like Topsy. And we have a very confusing and diverse system. We have many, many different types of daycare. Of course, there's family daycare, where a person takes several children into her own home. There is in-home care, which means that the parents have either a nanny or sometimes another family member or a neighbor come into their own homes and take care of the children. And then we have various kinds of daycare. Now, it's fascinating to me, now we have a great upsurge, a growth in care for infants and toddlers, and very, very young infants and toddlers. I mean children below 6 weeks of age. I went into a daycare center the other day. I know the daycare director very well, and she was very nervous. And I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "I don't believe this, but we have just enrolled a child who is 2 weeks old."
Oh, my.
2 weeks old. Mother was returning to work. Now, that is very questionable, especially since doctors, medical doctors, recommend 6 weeks leave of absence for a woman after she's had a baby.
Minimum. Yeah. Dr. Thelma Harms, you'll be interested to know, you may know this name, wrote a series called Raising America's Children. It came out in 1989, am I right there?
It was 1990.
In 1990. It is an award-winning 10-part television series that ran all over the country, including here in Alaska, in 1990. Raising America's Children is now distributed as videotapes, 10, 30-minute videotapes that help parents, help educators, daycare operators think about child development, think about raising children. Dr. Thelma Harms is our guest today on Conversations. Here's the $64,000 question. What would it take for this nation to revolutionize its thinking and its policies relative to its children, relative to its families?
You know, I think it's already starting to happen. I think what it will take is conviction on the part of industry, first of all, that there has to be an investment in the workforce. The workforce of today, the parents of the children, mm-hmm. and the workforce of tomorrow. And I think we're starting to see that revolution. In North Carolina, we have a big computer software company, I won't mention the name, that has a magnificent daycare center that is free to its employees. Now, people want to work for that company because of the daycare center and because of the way they are treated. They also have a terrific cafeteria that where, you know, in other words, they try to support their workforce. We have a number of companies like that across the country that feel that they want to make a contribution to education at all levels, and daycare is really the earliest part of education. It's helping children to become prepared for school and really to have the self-image that they are important and valuable, and it's helping families to work and fulfill their parental responsibilities. So I think there is a revolution starting in the awareness of industry. I think we also have to become aware politically that this is an important issue. And I was delighted when, during our last presidential election, daycare was brought up as an issue. And indeed, for the first time since 1976, during this administration, we had a daycare bill passed, and thank goodness it wasn't vetoed. But look what's happened to parental leave. That parental leave was passed, and it was vetoed.
Yeah.
So I think we have to make this. I think parents have to make early childhood education, they have to make daycare, but more important, they have to make family support a key issue.
Now, a lot of people would argue with you. They would say, "Dr. Harms, we don't have the money in this country to devote to this." I get the feeling from you that this isn't an issue of money. It's an issue of priority. You put your priority there, you'll figure out where the money is.
That, I think that's partially the case. I can just say this. Either we invest the money up front and avoid problems, or we spend the money at the other end on school dropouts, on children with lots of not only personal problems but learning disabilities and other problems that could largely be prevented by proper prenatal care and proper stimulation during early childhood. And what's really sadder is we spend the money on prisons and drug rehab.
Which is the ultimate back end.
Which is the ultimate back end. I don't think there's any way to avoid helping people function well in society. We have to help them. And the question is, do we help them in a preventative way and then have less problems? Or do we simply allow problems to develop and then do what we can. Now, I don't know whether to bring this up, but I think it's an interesting thing. I've been working with the problems of homeless children in North Carolina. Families with children are the largest growing segment of the homeless population.
Yes.
It seems shocking. We used to have a stereotype of the homeless hobo, usually male, and actually
he shelters. He hit the road. Right.
And shelters were set up for homeless men. Pretty soon they found homeless women, and they were a little nonplussed by that. Now shelters are being asked to deal with homeless families. And it is tragic. It is absolutely tragic. Because we have battered women's shelters where a woman must run away from an abusing spouse, takes her children with her, usually in the middle of the night. The kids have no toys, nothing. They have to flee to a shelter. These kids are absolutely traumatized. Or the parents have lost a job. Housing is a crucial issue. You know, we're in a housing crisis right now in the United States, and there are many families that are employed. They're what we call the underemployed. They have jobs, but not enough money is earned in order to pay for housing and daycare. So they find themselves homeless in many cases, although they are earners. They're not earning enough. So you have in the homeless shelters children who face being throwaway children. It's a terrible situation because they're missing out on the preventative medical care. They don't get their checkups. They don't get their inoculations. The only time they see a doctor is in an emergency room. Now, this is very shocking to me because these children will be going to school with everyone else's children.
Mm. Or missing school.
Or missing school, but most likely they will go to school. They will be the wage earners, if they can do it, of the future. So if you look at what's been happening, there is a tremendous neglect of the social responsibility for children. And you see, I'm not suggesting that we take over the parental role. I am simply suggesting that we support and help parents to take care of their children properly so that we don't have to work with the problems that are caused by neglect.
If you were queen, if you were president, to put you in the throne or in the executive mansion at this point, what would you do first? What would you say is the most important change America needs to make right now?
Gosh, this is probably one of the reasons I don't run for office. Oh, I think I would look first at programs like health care. Programs where we have already started to make some changes. Health care would be one of them certainly to look at because you could deal with prenatal care, you could deal with a whole range of issues that address the needs of families and the elderly and so on. So you need to do something certainly with health care. We had an opportunity to do something very important with daycare, with the new daycare bill, which gave enough money to deal in many ways with the need for quantity of care. In other words, there are many states that are increasing the number of daycare places, but it's not enough money to address the quality issue. Mm. So I think if we put some more money into the daycare bill so that we said people in various states have to deal with quality. You see, the quality part of it was taken out of the bill because many people said, we don't want the federal government to set standards that the states have to meet. Well, now, take a contrast between Alaska and North Carolina. In Alaska, the rule is that infant care, I think, has to have a 1-to-4 ratio, one caregiver to about 3 or 4 babies. Do you know what it is in North Carolina?
Let me know.
1-to-7. In other words, you can get a license in North Carolina, and have one caregiver for 7 babies under 1 year of age.
And keep track of them all day
long. Keep track of them. Yeah. I mean, it's impossible. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get it down to 1 to 6. That would still be very high. So if we had a federal regulation that said 1 to 4 and some more money were pumped in, we could have some good standards in daycare. But we always seem to stop short of dealing with the issue of quality. But I think certainly we certainly want to do something with health. We certainly want to do something with education and daycare, which I think is a terribly important issue. I think we could turn our country around in certainly in one generation if we really paid attention to children and raised a generation where we would have really skilled workers. Another thing is housing. We have a terrible housing crisis in this country. We need low-cost housing. I've never quite figured out why we don't put people to work at building their own housing. That would make so much sense to me. I remember a long time ago when I was in college, I remember hearing about slum renewal. Mm-hmm. We need slum renewal. We used to call them slums. We now call them inner cities. But and there were always people who said, well, why aren't we allowing people to learn skills by remodeling and rejuvenating these old neighborhoods? For some reason, those ideas just don't catch on. And I don't know why. It doesn't do us any good to have unemployed. It doesn't do us any good to lack housing. It seems to me we could be teaching people skills and allowing them to rejuvenate their neighborhoods. But I think if I were queen,
yes,
it would take me more than a day, though. I think I'd like to, I would look at those issues that strengthen families and that strengthen neighborhoods.
This is Dr. Thelma Harms. She is with us on Conversations here on KUAC. I'm Susan McGinnis. Let's talk more about strengthening families, but on a personal level. We've mm-hmm. discussed in this first half hour public policy. Let's look at strengthening families from the inside. There have been a couple of reports in the last couple of months that have sung a very sad litany of the quality of life of children in this country. From, we know about these things, so I'll make it very quick, child sexual abuse, child neglect and physical abuse of children. For teenagers, teenage pregnancy, drug and alcohol abuse, violence among teens, incarceration of teens, and teen suicide. These are those mm-hmm. that come most quickly to mind. If you had an opportunity to talk to parents, especially young parents now, what would be the first thought you would give to them in preventing this mm-hmm. scourge?
To me, the key issue is self-image, whether a child feels he's worth anything. How do you get a person to feel from the very beginning that he matters? And
now, what does that mean?
What does it mean? I have, at times, had interactions with little 3-year-olds who tell me, I'm a bad boy. I do bad things. And you'll say, you do? Yes. And they will tell you, my mommy doesn't like me. Mm. Or my daddy spanks me because I do bad things. You also see children who have a great deal of trouble finishing anything. They just don't think that they can do something. The whole story about the self-fulfilling prophecy.
Sure.
You know this idea that if you think other people don't like you, you behave in such a way that it makes them not like you. And the whole idea of feeling valuable, feeling worthy, comes from the very earliest of years. It comes from the way your parents relate to you, the way the caregiver in the daycare center diapers the baby, touches the baby, holds him, feeds him. Those are very basic things that we carry with us throughout life. The feeling of either being valued or not being valued. And I think that if you are privileged enough to be relating to a child and helping a child grow, whether you are a parent or whether you are a caregiver, that you have to treat that child in such a way that the child realizes he is a worthy and valuable person. You have to treat him with a certain kind of respect and consideration. And that means not treating the child in any way that you wouldn't treat a guest. I'll give you an example. I was visiting one day. I was having dinner at an acquaintance's home. And they had a little four-year-old who was there at the table. And these people were very gracious to me. But every once in a while, the father would look over at the little boy and he'd say, "Sit up straight." And then he'd go right, turn right back to me, and he was very nice to me. He'd also say, "Stop playing with your food." And then he'd turn to me and he'd be very nice. Now, I do not sit up very straight. And I have at times been known to kind of move things out of the way. And it made me feel so uneasy. I said to myself, "Oh, I hope he doesn't treat me this way." But you see, that father was using a tone of voice and behaving in a way to his child that he never would have behaved to a guest. And if you start thinking of the child as a human being who is valuable and important to you, you wouldn't treat your boss that way, you wouldn't treat your friend that way, you can't treat your child that way. There's a certain kind of respect as well as love. Now, that may sound difficult to do. It is difficult to do because we haven't been trained to be nice to one another. We are not really very nice to one another usually. We haven't been trained to do that. We're not very polite, and we're not very gentle with one another. We don't praise one another. We usually tell people what's wrong, but we don't tell people what's right. But, you know, I just think this whole issue of quality of life for children, if you can decenter, not be so egocentric, and look every once in a while to see what your child's life is like. What is it like to hurry out of the house every morning?
Get your coat, get your hat.
Get your coat, get your hat, eat your breakfast or take it in the car.
I'm double parked.
What is it like? I'm double parked. What is it like? That gives you a completely different picture. And you're the grown-up in the family. You can do a little better. You're tougher, you're bigger. You can get up a little earlier to avoid that daily trauma, if you at least see it as a trauma. You face certain decisions in your life. One of the decisions you face is whether to stay home with your baby for a certain amount of time or whether to go right back to work.
It's a very fraught and painful decision for any parent to make.
It is such a tough decision. It is such a tough decision. I think enough parents need to realize that this is a decision. Most people just automatically go back to work because they're expected to go back to work. I think we ought to do a lot more negotiation with the heads of departments. We need to do an awful lot of more negotiation with our budget. Not every family needs a fancy car or two cars. There are sacrifices that you can make. And I know this is a rough thing because we've been taught to want a lot young. You know, we want a lot. But I think when you realize that your baby is just going to be once, a young once, little once, that maybe the decision would be made to stay home a little longer time and take the consequences of having less material things, if at all possible, and then going back to work. So I think that's something that needs to be looked at. Another thing that needs to be looked at is when you are going to choose daycare, what do you look for? The hours that they're open and the convenience and the cost are all important things, but they're not the most important thing. In fact, I think people use a lot more discriminating factors or reasons when they purchase a car or any other big piece of equipment than when they purchase daycare. I mean, I have people sending me consumer reports when I want to buy a washing machine or a car. I can always borrow a consumer report. It seems that that is like the Bible of purchasing. Well, what do you do when you want to go out and purchase daycare? Because it's the same kind of thing. You are buying a service, a very, very important service. How much do you know about it? Now, I've spent half of my life making up evaluation instruments, as you know. And a couple of years ago, I wrote a checklist for Parents Magazine that tells people what kinds of questions they should be asking, what sorts of things they should be looking for when they go in and try out or consider a daycare center. You might say give a daycare center a test drive. You need to really know what you're looking for. And let me tell you a few of the things I think you need to look for.
Please.
Number one, you want the place to be clean and organized and cheerful. You don't want a place that's a really dirty mess. I don't mean a usual kind of disorganization, which you have a little few toys out of place. That shows the kids have been playing with them. But what you want is a place where people have organized so that they can manage a group of children without it being a terrible mess. Another thing you look for and you listen for is the way the children are treated. Because your baby or your child is going to be treated just the same way as you walk out the door. So if you hear a rough tone of voice, if you hear unpleasant crying and unpleasant things being said, or if children are crying or fighting and no one is paying attention to them, that's not a good place to leave your child, because your child is going to be subjected to exactly the same thing. So you look for people who not only are kind, but who have some skills, who know how to manage an argument among children, how to manage keeping toys in some sort of a sensible order, how to set up activities that the children enjoy. You look for a good, safe outdoor area, too, because that is important. Children do need to get out of doors. You look for the size of the group. It is not a good thing for young children to be in very large groups. You look for the number of adults that are around. That's called the staff-child ratio. So you want to have one staff member for about four babies. You want one staff member for seven or eight three-year-olds. You don't want to have huge groups of children, because there's no human being that has any more than two hands and two feet.
And a child gets lost in a group, like an adult gets lost in a group.
And passed over. So, you know, parents have a lot of decisions to make, and I think we need to let parents know that they have those decisions, and then the professional people in the field need to counsel parents and give them some knowledge about what you look for. I think the best advocate for a child is the parent. The parent knows the child, not only knows the child, but loves the child more than anybody else. And so parents should be given information so that they can make good decisions.
And be willing to go shopping.
And be willing to go shopping and not give up. And be inventive. I have known parents who couldn't find the daycare that they wanted for their children in their area. And three or four of them would get together. The one with the biggest and the best house said, okay, my house can be used. And they went out and hired a person to run a little daycare center in this one person's house. That's what they did. And they found that worked very well. So, I think there are lots of creative things that parents can do. It may be that you may have a friend who wants to stay home with her own baby and is willing to take care of yours, or willing to take care of your three-year-old, because she feels that's a priority in her life to stay home. She needs that little bit of extra income. But on the other hand, you may want to or need to go back to work. So I think you need to really look at the quality of life that your children are going to have and then do what you need to do to make a high quality of life possible.
You're talking about a level of empowerment as parents, something I think we don't talk enough about.
Yeah, we were talking, if you remember where this started, what do we need to do to avoid all these problems? And this whole idea of self-image, I know with my three children were brought up in Berkeley, California, during the height of all this drug craziness. I saw families literally go down the drain. I saw children leaving home. Fortunately, my kids didn't get into that. And I think part of it was that from the very beginning, they had a feeling that they were worthwhile and they had things they were interested in. They had things that they did that really interested them. In one case, it was baseball. In another case, it was music. They had things that really kept them going, and they also had parents that they could come and argue with.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in arguing. I think that's a sign that you're communicating. They could come and bring their problems home. They could come and say, but I don't believe what you believe, Mom. You're not my boss.
And that was okay.
It was okay.
You didn't say, you're in my house, you believe what
no.
I believe, or keep your
no,
mouth
I
shut.
Didn't. No, I didn't. I would stand up for what I believed in. And at a certain point, I would say, listen, I've heard your argument. You've heard my argument. I'm bigger. I'm older.
I'm the mother.
I couldn't say I'm bigger for very long. But I'm the mother, and it's my decision to make, and this is the decision I'm making, and this is why. And that was accepted. But you see, we had learned how to communicate as a family, and they trusted me, and they could come and tell me and tell their dad what was going on and keep that communication open. Another thing you can't give up. If you look at children who have gotten into trouble at one point or another, the kid who pulls through is the kid whose parents don't give up, the parent who goes out and gets the help that's needed at the rough spots. You go out and you get help, and you get advice, and you get guidance, because you're not going to give up on this kid. And it's an amazing thing to see. One time in Berkeley, my husband stopped at a stoplight, and a young, bearded, very disheveled young man knocked on the window of the door. And I looked the other way. And he knocked on the door, and he said, Mrs. Harms, you know me. And I looked at him and said, no, I don't know you. And he said, yes, you do. And he said what his name was, and he was one of my son's friends in public school, in grade school. And so I rolled down the window and chatted with this young man for a little while. What I'm trying to bring out is this kid's parents stayed right with him. He went through a terrible patch, got into drugs and all sorts of other things, but his parents really kept with him. And I've seen him recently, and he's pulled out of his whole thing. But it was so interesting. He wanted to make contact with me, even though he was in this terrible state. He said, but you do know me.
Uh-huh.
You see, he was still there behind all of this, disheveled appearance and so on. So you got to stay with him.
This is Dr. Thelma Harms. She is with us from the University of North Carolina. She has been working with kids since she entered into a parents' cooperative in Berkeley in the 50s. Before that, she'd studied German and English in college, taken her master's in German after a double BA in German and English. Then she started a career in early childhood education as a participating parent in a parent cooperative in Berkeley, and began to teach in parent cooperatives before earning her graduate degrees. Those degrees are another master's in child development taken from UC Berkeley, and then a PhD in early childhood education at UC Berkeley. She worked with children at a child study center at UC Berkeley from 1959 to 1975. In 1975, she moved to the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Center at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She now directs their curriculum development program and their daycare technical assistance program. So 40 years plus in working with children.
I should say I took about 7 years out of that time to be home with my own.
With your children.
And I will never regret it. They got a very good start. And for me, it was possible. It meant sacrifices. A husband who was still in school, you know, the type that goes back. Mm-hmm. We kept sending one another back to school to get our various degrees. But that was a very important part of my life. That happened between my German professor years. I taught German on the college level, had these children, stayed home with them, and discovered that I was fascinated by people and fascinated by child development. So when I got ready to go back, I didn't finish the doctorate in German. I went back and got a master's in child development. But I don't want to make parents who, women especially, who need to work or want to work, feel that they're doing the wrong thing.
This is a terrible problem.
That's a terrible problem. Yeah.
On both sides, actually. People who are working at home feel that there is a social pressure to work outside the home, and then, my God, what do I do with the children?
What do I do?
Mm-hmm. People who feel they must or need to, in a spiritual sense, economically or spiritually, go back into the workforce feel that both the personal and public pressures are that they're neglecting their children.
Exactly. I think no matter whether you stay home with your children or you use daycare of some kind, the parent is still the person raising the child. The parent is still the person who loves that child and knows that child best. Your job as a parent is to find a high quality of life for that child, either at home with you or in a daycare center.
And then at home with you.
And then at home with you. The child needs quality time and quality of life in both of those settings. So you can't escape that responsibility. If you're miserable at home, and you really should be working part-time or all the time, a full day, you're not going to be doing your child any good at home. On the other hand, if you can stay home, especially during the first 5 or 6 months, I think that is very, very wise. If you can gradually go back to work, in other words, go back half-time, and then build up to full-time without losing an awful lot at your job, try to do that. But when you decide on daycare, you have to make that selection very, very carefully, because that daycare center is not just caring for your child and returning him at the end of the day in the same condition that you sent him. Mm-hmm. There should be something good that happened that day to the child. So those people are now partners with you in child rearing. They are partners with you. And I think that makes it a very much more serious issue. It isn't that your child is going to be marking time during that day.
No more than he or she would mark time at school.
At school or at home. Right. You want the child to gain during that day,
right,
to feel happy, to be satisfied, to be stimulated, to have a real relationship with other children and with that care provider. So it's a question of each individual family making decisions for themselves. But when they're making those decisions, they have to be realistic and look at their child and say, what am I giving this child? What am I taking away? What do I want to do?
And then ultimately, that decision, however it is made, must become the positive decision for the family. Is that true? We cannot then say, we have to do this in this way. Yeah. We must say, this is our path, right?
Well, this is our path, and do the best that you can with it. Do the best that you can with it.
I want to make a turn here. We've got about 10 minutes left, and I don't want to leave you or have you leave our listeners without talking about discipline for kids.
Oh, yes.
This is a subject that Dr. Thelma Harms has written on extensively at the University of North Carolina. When you talk about discipline, and before I get away, I should tell you that If you would like to write to us here at KUAC and ask for either her checklist of daycare centers and choosing them, or an article on discipline, you can do so. Write to me. I'm Susan McGinnis, your host of Conversations. KUAC, University of Alaska Fairbanks. The zip is 99775-1420, and I'll give that to you again before we close today. When you discuss discipline, you're talking about discipline as something that creates self-discipline in
exactly.
children. Now, how do you make that connection?
Well, when children are very young, they need a lot of guidance. They need a lot of help. But what we really want to do is to help children develop the ability to be self-disciplined, to make appropriate choices, and to become constructive in their behavior. So if you think of discipline as something a child develops, not something that you do and you make a child obey, and therefore he's disciplined.
Sit up straight. Stop playing with your
right.
food.
Right. Right. That's right. Yeah. Because you can, when you say sit up straight, you can make me sit up straight, but believe me, I'm going to slump the next minute. You know? You say don't play with your food, and you may make them stop momentarily, but you have to figure out why it is that they're playing with their food. Mm. Is it because you've put too much on the plate? Is it because they're not hungry? Is it because maybe they want to go off and play with something else? In other words, is the feeding proper and appropriate? One time, my husband pointed out something really very important to me. One of our sons constantly knocked his glass of milk over at the table. And, you know, there's nothing more discouraging. You've just got the table set, everybody is seated, and suddenly, ka-plunk, the milk glass goes over and there's great consternation. And what my husband pointed out was that I would fill the glass up and put it down in the same place where it came into contact with this little waving arm. What I mean is we don't watch enough, we don't observe enough and try to avoid problems.
Yeah.
It's about observation. And it's also about learning something about how your child works. Now, Susan, I'm so glad you're going to be giving out this article, because what I've done in this article is that I've talked about 12 building blocks of self-discipline. Do you have the article here?
Yeah, it's here. And actually, we've got about 5 minutes.
Yeah, well, maybe we could, maybe I could talk a little bit about these 12 building blocks, because, you know, it's kind of, they're said very succinctly. One, I think the first building block is expressing love. And again, that's related to the self-worth. And you have to be pretty obvious to kids when you express love. You have to smile at them. You have to have a nice tone of voice with them. You have to hug them so they know you mean it. A second thing that helps kids build self-discipline is being predictable. You can't be Attila the Hun 1 minute and sweetie old cutie pie the next. You have to have a certain predictability about yourself, about what you don't like and what you do like, and also about your home, so that they know where they're supposed to play and what they're supposed to play with.
This is part of establishing boundaries.
Establishing boundaries, mm-hmm. removing the breakables. Don't put them out one day and forget that you really want to put them away the next. So that there's some predictability, so the kid can count on something. Mm-hmm. Another thing, the third, is communicate clearly. Don't give double and triple messages. Just communicate very clearly. If you say to your child, "You little Dickens, don't you run out in front of the cars in the street," your voice is saying, "Oh, I just think what you did is great."
It's a game.
It's a game. Yeah. It isn't a game. If you don't want your kid running out into the street, you need to bring him back. You don't need to spank him. That's not necessary. But you need to bring him back, and you need to hold his hands and say, "No, not in the street. Play here." Because he has to know that's serious business. So your communication has to be clear. You have to start figuring out why problem behavior occurs. And it's an easy thing to do if you become a good observer. if you figure out what time of the day does my kid get cranky and start hitting his baby brother? Why is it happening every day at 4:30? Is it because he's tired? Is it because he's hungry? What can I do to avoid that behavior? So you start looking for patterns, and that takes a little bit of observation, of watching. Fifth is catch children being good. We're always catching people doing the wrong thing. We catch children doing the wrong thing. We give them attention for doing the wrong thing. They continue to do the wrong thing. In other words, catch children and praise them for the right thing. Set up a safe environment where they can explore safely and get interesting things to do. Set sensible limits. Limits that a 2-year-old can reach for 2-year-olds, and that a 3-year-old and 4-year-old can reach for their age group. And then stick to those limits and help the kids stay within those limits. Another thing is to teach problem-solving skills. So what I do here is go through the 12 building blocks of discipline and try to explain them. People tell me, people usually put me in a bind and say, so, Dr. Harms, you don't believe in spanking. That's not the issue. It's much better if you can work with your child in such a way that you don't spank, because spanking does not help build trust and love between parents and children.
Once again, this is an issue of dealing with the problem at the front end.
At the front end.
So you don't have to deal with the consequences.
That's right. That's right. And I must tell you that lots of people, including me, have been able to raise children without spanking them. If you know how to work with children, and if you're patient, I think you can do this. And spanking should never be equated with discipline. You can raise a child who is self-disciplined without spanking, without screaming, if you know what you're doing.
Dr. Thelma Harms, I want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
For joining us. Let me get a chance to say this one more time. If you'd like to, as a listener, take a look at this 12 building blocks of discipline more closely, or the checklist for finding a daycare center, write to me. I'm Susan McGinnis, your host for Conversations at KUAC. We're at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and the only other thing you have to remember is a zip code, 99775-1420. That's 99775-1420. Make it easy on me. Send a self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'll send it right back to you. Thanks a lot for listening. Thank you, Dr. Thelma Harms.
Thank you.
And I hope you'll tune us in again next week.